Meet the Antifa today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. After the violence in Charlottesville, one group of counter-protesters is in the spotlight, the Antifa, or anti-fascist activists. We'll hear from one of them.
For me, Antifa means just a movement that's dedicated to resisting all forms of oppression.
Showing up to counter a white supremacist march isn't for everyone, though.
There's a whole bunch of other ways that we as citizens have to start showing up and engaging that well precede or and also follow the day of the march.
And later, fans from all over the globe gather at Graceland for the anniversary of Elvis's death.
All the way from Tokyo.
Yeah.
Why?
Why? Yeah. Because I love him.
It's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. A lot to get to on the show this Wednesday, but this morning, reflecting on the latest news from President Trump, I was reminded of Spike Lee's 1989 film, Do the Right Thing, and Radio Raheem's monologue about love and hate.
Hate. It was with this hand that Cain iced his brother. Love. These five fingers, they go straight to the soul of man.
Hate versus love. Let me start by saying that it is not either or, not if we 7 billion plus people on Earth expect to advance our species in any meaningful way. And right now, there is a sense that hate is a path. Among white supremacists, Klansmen, neo-Nazis, hate is not a path. But how do we engage positively in this atmosphere of hate? We're starting The World today with Eric Liu. He's the founder of Citizen University. It's an organization that focuses on helping people become effective, change-making citizens.
I think it all begins with looking inward, each of us, particularly those who are called white, have to look inward and actually take inventory of what are the kinds of privilege I've got? What are the ways in which I am exempt from some of the fears and hatred that are out there? And so what is my responsibility for stepping up, stepping in, showing up and speaking out for people who are vulnerable to this kind of racism and hate and bigotry out there? And when you take that kind of inventory and you reflect on yourself honestly in a way that is about taking responsibility and not saying, well, they started it or someone else, it's someone else's problem or someone else is making it worse, simply asking, what is my piece of this? What can I do? That's not where we end, but that's certainly where I think we've got to begin.
Yeah. So what is kind of the next step? Because surely just thinking about one's white privilege, if you're white, isn't enough.
Yeah. And by the way, if you're not white, ways in which that privilege
right,
benefits you too. But, you know, the next step after you reflect, I think, is in fact to commit to show up.
Well, there are various white nationalist rallies planned across the country in the coming days, right here in Boston on Saturday, in fact. It's billed as a free speech rally. And I know local lawmakers are pretty suspicious of what it's going to be. But people I know are wondering whether they should go and even dignify the white supremacist presence with an opposing presence. So should people go to oppose or stay away? What is the best way for people to respond?
You know, I think it actually my first instinct was that we should go. But as I've reflected on it more, Marco, I actually think we should not. I think we should collectively, those of us who oppose hate and bigotry, should collectively decide we're not going to play the game on the terms of those who are promoting hate and bigotry. And when you show up at their rallies and feed into the atmosphere of conflict and rage and fury that often can spill into violence, at the end of the day, you're only feeding their way of creating division and conflict. I think far more effective for us as peace-loving and tolerant citizens is to organize a different rally, maybe even at the same time, but in a different part of town. Organize a different vigil, maybe, you know, later on or the next day, that shows on our terms in affirmative ways what it looks like to build the beloved community, what it looks like to invite the full diversity of our actual community and country, and to do that with a spirit of joyful purpose and love, creating that kind of counterpresence rather than feeding the hate mongers with attention, because attention is their oxygen, is the way to go. But I think, Marco, even beyond what we do on the day of a given hate rally, I think the bigger picture is that all of us who are concerned about these kinds of rallies and actions have to be organizing each other as citizens in a whole spectrum of ways.
So you're saying there are many different ways of showing up.
There are many different ways of showing up. I mean, I think if you organize your neighbors, your family, your friends, your fellow parishioners or faithful, your believers into donating money to organizations that are combating hate, organizations that are helping young people around the country reckon with hard moral choices of dealing with history, whether it's a Nazi past or Jim Crow or other things. When you have a president who can't tell the moral difference between a George Washington and a Robert E. Lee, it makes you realize that it's worth facing history together as a community. But it also means organizing your votes and your voices to pressure lawmakers to do the right thing, to protect disfavored groups, and organizing people who have influence, teachers, preachers, coaches, mentors in your neighborhood and your block and your community to form a phalanx of good faith here. To say, we're going to be the ones actually who in small ways, off the grid, not in these big public conflicts, are going to start the uncomfortable conversations about how we as a society face white supremacy, dismantle it, and move forward together. And I do believe it's possible in a bottom-up way.
I think a lot of people, and I think you'll agree, are angry and discouraged right now, especially after Trump came out yesterday, again blaming both sides for the violence in Charlottesville. In this climate, how optimistic are you that it's possible to achieve any sort of systemic change?
Oh, I'm very optimistic. I actually think that for all the noise and the fury of these white nationalists and neo-Nazis, theirs is the fury of a dying group, not the surge of a prevailing group. And when you have – it is incredibly saddening for the republic that we have a president who was unable to find moral clarity in the days after Charlottesville. And that is both saddening and angering. But again, it's not about the president. I think – what the silver lining of what's happened in the days after Charlottesville is that tens of millions of Americans are awakened. Tens of millions of Americans who previously were looking at these kinds of conflicts and issues as, quote, someone else's problem, as a fight between extremists on this side and that side, now realize, no, this is my fight. This is a fight that's really clear between those who want to coddle white supremacists and neo-Nazis and those who want to build actually an inclusive country. And that sharpening of focus for so many millions of Americans says to me that, if we can keep, creating pathways for people to show up and engage, not just on the day of the protest and the dramatic conflict on the streets, but to show up in everyday smaller ways as citizens, then I think we're going to be able to change things in the right direction.
Eric, your parents came to the U.S. from China. What did they instill in you about the values of this country, and how did you decide to pay that forward?
You know, when my parents, they were born in China, they came to the United States via Taiwan, and all I had was the dumb luck to be born here in the United States. You look at other folks who had to fight and scrap and scrape their way to get here and now live in a culture where they are under such a great shadow of disfavorment. It is a privilege to be able to take for granted citizenship as a matter of documentation. And what it reminds us is that citizenship is a bigger, deeper thing. Forget about the documents. I'm talking about this ethical sense of, are you a member of the body? Are you a pro-social contributor to community, a non-sociopath? And citizenship in that sense is something that all of us, I think, have an opportunity and a responsibility to live out, especially in times of hate and conflict like now.
Eric Liu is the founder of Citizen University. He's also the author of You're More Powerful Than You Think, A Citizen's Guide to Making Change Happen. As we've been hearing, President Trump yesterday reverted to blaming what he called both sides for the violence at the white nationalist rally in Charlottesville on Saturday. In particular, Trump criticized what he called the alt-left. Trump is getting blasted from left and right for essentially equating right-wing hate groups with anti-racist protesters. As for the alt-left, well, it doesn't really seem to be a thing. But the world's Lydia Jean Cott, who was in Charlottesville last weekend, spoke with someone who's the kind of person that the president might have been thinking of.
Peter lives in Charlottesville. He didn't want me to use his real name because he's afraid of becoming a target. He was one of the counter-protesters that President Trump referred to out on the front lines on Saturday.
They came charging with clubs in their hands, swinging clubs.
Peter's not actually that intimidating, though. He's a college student with blonde hair, a little bit of acne. He's studying philosophy and physics. I first reached out to him back in July because I wanted to know more about this movement he's part of. It's called Antifa, short for anti-fascist.
For me, Antifa means just a movement that's dedicated to resisting all forms of oppression.
Different members of Antifa can believe different things. Lots of people I talk to even pronounce the name differently. But the one thing they all have in common is they believe it's important to keep racists from expressing their views in public. That can mean publicly shaming them or even physically confronting them. In February, in Berkeley, Antifa activists in masks broke store windows and threw rocks and Molotov cocktails at the police. It was during a protest against a planned speech by the alt-right blogger Milo Yiannopoulos. Peter says he got involved in Antifa in college, in part through studying philosophy. Antifa is a movement with a long history. It began in Europe in the 1920s and 30s, when leftist groups formed militias to fight fascist armies. And now, well, it's growing again.
I know for me, certainly, I really would not have considered any of this kind of organizing to even be necessary before Donald Trump was elected.
I met up with Peter at the rally in Charlottesville after the police shut it down and people were starting to disperse. I asked him about what things were like out there on the front lines.
I mean, the whole thing has been scary. Like, anybody who's telling you otherwise is lying through their teeth. This entire thing has been pretty terrifying.
Peter said people on both sides were throwing things like water bottles. His hands were stained from overturning a tear gas canister. We only talked for a few minutes. He told me that he heard white supremacists were gathering in a different park, and he was going there next.
I mean, there are still a lot of people here that we don't want here. And, you know, so hopefully the events of the rest of the day and maybe going into tomorrow a little bit will convince them that they don't want to come back.
A couple hours later, Peter texted that he was in the hospital. He had been one of those hit by the car that drove into a group of counter-protesters, killing one woman and injuring 19. His injuries were minor, just cuts and bruises, and he was home by the end of the day. He was lucky. The videos and photos were horrific. They showed people flying through the air, shoes scattering the sidewalk. I called up Peter after President Trump made his remarks about Charlottesville on Tuesday. Peter hadn't seen the news, so I summarized it for him, wondering how he would react.
Yeah, wow, that's a lot.
He sounded different from the first time we talked, a little angrier, but also a little gentler at the same time. I asked him about the car attack, but he said that he's had to describe it too many times already.
It's been a lot of talking about it, and I've driven past the memorial site quite a few times, and it's still, it's a little bit too hard to see and to talk about too much right now.
I asked him about how he thought this would affect him from now on.
For better or for worse, this is definitely going to be one of the most significant moments in my life, I think, and it hasn't managed to break me. I hope to come out of this with lessons on how to be stronger and how to be better, how to keep people safer, and just hopefully turn this horrific experience into something I can take away some positives from.
How do we keep people safer? I'm not sure I agree with Peter's answer that sometimes that might require violence, but I think he has the right question. For The World, I'm Lydia Jean Cott.
What's at stake for Mexico, the U.S., and Canada as talks to renegotiate NAFTA get underway? That's coming up right here on The World.
Support for The World's podcast comes from LegalZoom. It's National Make-A-Will Month at LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but they're dedicated to helping Americans take control of their family's futures with a free estate planning kit, which contains an educational ebook, LegalZoom discounts, and other helpful information. Get your free estate planning kit today at LegalZoom.com/prepare. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. LegalZoom.com/prepare.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. President Trump has vowed to reverse much of the legacy of his predecessor, Barack Obama. But Trump is reaching even further back for one policy reversal. Presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton ushered in the North American Free Trade Agreement with Canada and Mexico in the 1990s. Trump has called NAFTA the worst trade deal in history, and he wants major changes to it. And starting today, the president gets to try to make good on that promise as talks opened to renegotiate NAFTA. If the president can't get his way, he's threatened to pull the U.S. out of the deal. But what exactly is Trump trying to accomplish with any or all of this, and what can he accomplish? The World's Jason Margolis covers trade for us. The president wants to bring back manufacturing jobs to the U.S., Jason. Can he do that?
It's going to be very hard. He has a challenge, and we've seen a lot of manufacturing jobs disappear over the last 20 years, but to blame it all on NAFTA is far too simplistic. A lot of manufacturing jobs went away when China joined the WTO. A lot of jobs have been lost to robots and automation. A lot of jobs were lost during the Great Recession. And how many jobs were lost to Mexico because of NAFTA? I asked an economist, Mark Mellitz at Harvard University, who studies this, and this is what he told me.
My estimate is right around zero. Because the trade agreements really, they are not about changing overall employment. They change the composition of jobs that are available in both of the economies.
So the judgment that NAFTA was terrible for American workers, it's not a unanimous call, is it?
Right. So he's saying zero jobs were lost overall. To say no jobs were lost, it really would sting to someone in the Rust Belt who used to be making cars and now they're made in Mexico. But in sum, jobs are created and jobs are lost. And this constant churn in our economy, when you look at how many jobs were lost to NAFTA, he believes it was zero.
Trump talks a lot about the trade deficit with Mexico, how we're getting ripped off by Mexico. Is that true? And can he correct that if it is true?
We are ripped off. We are importing a lot more than we export, about $64 billion more with Mexico. Economists say, does it matter? No. You go to the grocery store, so you're spending money because you want to buy things at that grocery store. You like avocados in season from Mexico, so we're buying a lot more stuff. And economists say that shows our strength. We have the money to buy it.
So can Trump get a win, what he would consider a win on NAFTA?
In President Trump's world, I think there are winners and there are losers. I don't think that's a stretch to say, right? But each country that signs onto a trade agreement has to be a winner, or else they wouldn't do it. So I spoke with Timothy A. Wise a while back. He's with the Small Planet Institute in Cambridge, and he had this really nice quote, which I want to play again for you.
The president of Mexico arrives at the negotiations with the goal of making Mexico great again, not the goal of making America great again.
So yeah, the point is Canada, the U.S., Mexico, they all are coming to the tables hoping to accomplish something. And if President Trump thinks he can just browbeat Canada and Mexico into getting exactly what he wants, he's wrong.
Will he get the votes from Congress to make the changes? Because that's a big question, too, especially given the current mood and what seems to be Trump's increasing isolation in Washington.
So that is super interesting because he's more on the side of Democrats with renegotiating trade deals. Is he going to align with Democrats? Are Democrats going to swallow their pride and work with President Trump to get improvements to NAFTA? Because everyone agrees that NAFTA needs an update. But is his big signature accomplishment going to get the votes with Democrats? I don't know.
Yeah, hard to imagine. The World's Jason Margolis covers trade for us. Where else can listeners find out what you've been looking into?
You could go to PRI.org and just type in NAFTA, and you'll find all sorts of stuff from tomato growers in Florida to workers building air conditioners in Indiana and Mexico.
Jason, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Before NAFTA, there was Elvis, and it was 40 years ago today that Elvis Presley died, August 16th, 1977. And 40 years later, the king, as millions called him, still has millions of devotees. Last night, many of them held a candlelight vigil at Graceland, Elvis's home in Memphis. And while Elvis was a distinctly American icon, the anniversary is drawing fans from all over the globe. Here's my BBC colleague, Laura Bicker, in Memphis.
Welcome to Memphis. Maybe I didn't treat you.
In the meditation garden of Graceland, I find Kath and Mitzi from Essex sitting arm in arm in the shade. They've been planning and saving for this trip for 7 years, and they finally made it.
The undisputed king of rock and roll, Elvis Presley, is dead. Stunned fans mill around the gates of Elvis Presley.
Elvis Presley, the one-time king of popular music, is dead at the age of 42.
40 years ago, Mitzi ran to Kath's house to tell her Elvis was dead.
He died, and we did all the weeping and wailing. And
the two girls locked themselves in their room and cried. The king means as much to them now as he did back then.
That's, you know, why everybody's here, because he's just up there, you know, age after age after age.
Age timeless, still loving, really, aren't they? So my 11-year-old grandson is sort of jealous. Oh, my God, Nanny Kath, don't cry too much and bring me back some pictures. And he's really keen too. So I think we've passed it on, don't you, the enthusiasm.
And the love.
The gift shops and museums around the Memphis mansion are alive with language from all over the world.
35
times. Yeah.
No, all the way from Tokyo.
Yes.
That's amazing. Oh. Why?
Why? Yeah. Because I love him.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lone Street, that heartbreak hotel.
Born dirt poor in Tupelo, Mississippi, Elvis picked up a guitar at the age of 11. He was heavily influenced by local gospel groups. His family moved to Memphis in search of a better life, and it was there, at the age of 18, he walked into Sun Studios and recorded two songs. Legend has it they were for his mother. He was paid $4, but his style, his voice, changed rock and roll forever. His first big hit was Heartbreak Hotel at the age of 21. His friend, Jerry Schilling, said that in a segregated Memphis, it was dangerous to go and buy black music. There are few unifying figures around the world, but he believes Elvis was one of them.
Before we discovered rhythm and blues and turned it into rock and roll, your music was your parents' music. I think in the long run was so important because it broke down so many barriers because we weren't allowed to mix with black people or, you know, do anything. Entertainment, school, it was totally segregated. Water fountains, whatever. And where maybe religion or politics didn't bridge these gaps, the music did. And Elvis was right on that leading edge.
Well, this is the moment so many fans have been waiting for all day. A torch is held by Lisa Marie Presley, and she lights it from the eternal flame. And one by one, these fans file through, light their candle, and make their way up the hill to Elvis Presley's graveside, where they can take a moment in the meditation garden.
Do you still miss him?
Every day, yeah.
Elvis Presley's friend Jerry Schilling there, ending that report from the BBC's Laura Bicker in Memphis. Today marks the 40th anniversary of Elvis Presley's death.
I like words.
A podcast.
Fat, buttery words.
About language.
Sniggly, chuckling words.
The world in words.
Wormy, squirmy, mealy words.
The world in words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. How do you talk about racism with someone who disagrees with you?
Don't try to hold the punches, but really say, listen, I don't know much, but I want to learn. I hope you don't mind. I might offend you with some ignorant questions, but I come from a place of sincerity.
Some ideas from writer Wajahat Ali. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Donald Trump is not known for his strong grasp of history, but yesterday he claimed leftists in this country were rewriting history by destroying monuments.
This week it's Robert E. Lee. I noticed that Stonewall Jackson's coming down. I wonder, is it George Washington next week, and is it Thomas Jefferson the week after? You know, you really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Everyone seems to have an opinion on this right now, but we wanted to speak with someone who's given this a lot of thought. Laurent Dubois, professor of history at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. And Laurent, since you are in Durham, let me just start by asking you to tell us what your reaction was to the destruction of a statue of a Confederate soldier at the old Durham County Courthouse. This was on Monday night, so after the Charlottesville violence 2 days earlier.
Well, it was a really striking moment. I was not there. I just saw it on social media like a lot of other people. But I immediately just started thinking about so many other incidents I could think of in world history where taking down monuments or knocking them over was part of political change and political struggle. So I watched it. I once, as a kind of member of the Durham community who had seen that monument frequently and understood its history and understood the activism that was going on here, but also more broadly as a historian, just thinking about its connection both to our history and to global histories of monuments.
Yeah. Is there like one really rich example of a monument that's been taken down, kind of an echo of that change in history that you were talking about?
Well, there's so many examples I can think of a lot of examples in the Caribbean, which is where a lot of my work focuses on, where the questions have been similar because they're really around the memory of slavery and the ways in which kind of colonialism and slavery are present in monuments. So there's an example in Martinique where activists actually decapitated a statue of the Empress Josephine, and the city just has allowed it to remain like that. So it's been up there for now 30 years or so. In the middle of the town square, you have a monument that's been transformed by activists, and that Martinicans now see as a kind of their monument in the way that they've reclaimed it in a certain way.
Right. So this is a headless Josephine in a French overseas territory, right?
Exactly. And the activists who did that were independence activists critiquing the colonial history of France. So it's quite a vivid example of that. What I'd say about statues, I think, is that a monument always has to do with three different historical moments, right? It's a reference to a particular moment in the past. It's also a representation of the moment when it was built. It sort of speaks to the moment when the monument was built. And then we in the present have to think about these monuments and what they mean today and whether they fit with our values as a society.
Well, there was an interesting suggestion I saw on Facebook yesterday, reposted by a friend. The thought was to leave all the racist, Confederacy-loving, shameful statues in place and intact, but put up a huge plaque next to them, perhaps, that explains exactly why they were erected in the first place. And mm-hmm. It was intriguing because it seems that if we get rid of all of these statues, no one will remember the shameful circumstances that enabled their placement to start with. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Well, I think you could do that actually with the empty pedestals, which I have a feeling is what's partly going to happen in Baltimore and maybe in Durham. I suggested this morning that what I think would be interesting is to have a kind of acknowledgement of the monument that was there, maybe even a photograph of the monument that explains when it was built and why. And then perhaps actually some other text that describes why it was taken down and why the society decided to change it at this point. And in that sense, you'd actually get a sense of the kind of dynamism of history and the fact that monuments are about, you know, public declaration of values. It's also the case that we need to kind of cultivate and expand a broader historical memory. So the history of slavery itself, the history of abolitionists, the history of how slavery was destroyed, the history of the enslaved people who fought against slavery, all those are things that could be much better known and much more present in our public spaces. So one solution is to think about that, is to think about, you know, both the removal of some monuments, but also what kinds of public art, what kinds of public recognition of history do we want to foreground? And there are lots and lots of Americans who have fought for justice and equality, who fought against slavery, who could be acknowledged and who could be celebrated. And that's I think, another way to think about it.
Let me go further down the line. What about graves? I mean, I've seen calls even for graves and memorials to the Confederate war dead to be removed as well. Has that happened elsewhere in the world? Like, what do they do in Germany, for example?
Graves, I think, are generally considered a really different situation, obviously, just because of the kind of the sacredness that people have around graveyards. Of course, monuments to the dead are a kind of in between, right? Most monuments are not actually graves, but a lot of monuments around the world have names, particular names. And I think there's a lot of gradations there. There are, of course, yes, monuments to the dead in Germany. And I think those kinds of questions are really, really complicated. Obviously, in our own country, the whole history of the Vietnam War Memorial, which itself was an extremely controversial memorial when it was built, and many people disliked it at the time, precisely because it wasn't seen as heroic enough. It's a very different kind of monument than you usually see. So we've had many struggles around this in our own country about exactly how you memorialize people.
Laurent Dubois, professor of history at Duke University in Durham. Thank you very much. Great to speak.
Thanks.
How we remember and memorialize events, it's an issue also in South Asia. This week marks the 70th anniversary of the partition of India. When the country won its independence from Britain in 1947, it split in two, mostly Hindu India in the middle and the newly created and mostly Muslim Pakistan to the east and west. The partition set in motion a mass migration with millions of Hindus, Sikhs, and Muslims displaced overnight. It also sparked horrific violence. Hundreds of thousands of people were killed. The event has been described as a mutual genocide, but there was never a museum to commemorate it until now. Here's reporter Sandeep Roy.
When Gunita Singh Bhalla was a child in India, her grandmother told her horror stories about what happened to her childhood friends during partition.
Everybody used to sleep on the rooftops in those days, and how when the floods came that year, the water was red because of all of the bloodshed that happened in the streets.
Yet when Bhalla came to America and went to high school, she learned about Hiroshima and the Holocaust, but not the partition of India.
Partition was not even a sentence. And when I mentioned it to my teacher in high school, I remember her saying that, you know, maybe it was an exaggeration. It was not as big of a thing because it's not in our textbooks.
Bhalla is now the executive director of the 1947 Partition Archive, born in a tech incubator hub in Berkeley. It has been training volunteers to take oral histories of partition before the survivors and their stories disappear. Like this from Ajit Kaur. She and her parents went to a town near Delhi for a few weeks in the summer of 1947. Her grandparents stayed behind in Lahore, which became a part of Pakistan, and the family was separated by a new border. She remembers her father hearing about the carnage on the radio.
We got up hearing my father sobbing, and we saw our father's beard had gone half grey. He couldn't bear the shock.
Some 4,000 stories later, the archive is available to the public through universities in the United States and South Asia, a sort of digital museum. And now, on the 70th anniversary of partition, a brick-and-mortar museum is finally opening at the Old Town Hall in Amritsar in Punjab. Lady Kishwar Desai is the chair of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Trust, which is overseeing the project. Here she's speaking to India's Rajya Sabha TV.
The idea behind this museum is that the fact that most of the partition survivors are now in their 80s and 90s, it's been 70 years since the partition of India, and we haven't done anything to commemorate them or remember them in any way.
There are many reasons why that never happened. There's still so much trauma, splintered families, lost homes. Desai says after partition, her parents' generation was just preoccupied with survival. Her father, a student in Lahore, could never finish his PhD because he lost his papers in the displacement to India. And of course, the ongoing political tensions and outright wars between India and Pakistan made it harder, says Bhalla.
Because a lot of the memory has been shaped by politics, and I think it would be really challenging, especially given the Indo-Pak relations and how they're viewed publicly.
Both of these remembrance projects try to steer away from the minefield of South Asia politics. They focus on the human story of all the people who were caught in the fault lines. The museum has been collecting things that people carried with them. Things like a box in which a little girl brought her dolls, property deeds for land that could never be claimed, sketches drawn with dirt and mud in a refugee camp. Desai tells me over a scratchy phone line that some women sent in wedding saris.
You know, when they left, that was the one thing they brought with them. So it's very touching.
The museum also recounts stories of hope and heroism. India's former chief election commissioner, Naveen Chawla, tells the museum that his mother, a doctor, tried to save the children of her Muslim patients who chose to stay on in their homes in Delhi but wanted their children out of harm's way.
They would give their little children to my mother, who'd bring them in her car, hide them under our beds, and send them to the safety of Hyderabad and other places.
The museum is open to all these stories, says Desai. It does not matter whether they're from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, or the diaspora. Chawla says he just wishes this museum had happened sooner.
I wish its time had come two or three decades ago, but doesn't matter. It's come now.
The Partition Museum officially opens its doors on August 17th. For the world, I'm Sandeep Roy.
Roughly 200 million people live within a day's drive of next Monday's eclipse, which means we could see one of the largest, if not the largest, single exodus of humans across U.S. territory in history. But those eclipse chasers will also be joined by others from around the world, and they'll be traveling much farther to stand in the shadow of the moon for just a few minutes. Terry Cuttle is en route from Australia to the U.S. to watch eclipse number 16. So where are you going to be for this one? Where in the United States?
Well, I'm heading for Idaho. It's a place that has reasonably good weather prospects. It's no guarantee, of course, and I need a bit of flexibility. So I'm headed for Idaho, basically in the eastern side, but I've also got a backup plan in terms of the weather isn't particularly favorable, then I've got an option to head either east or west from there.
I mean, that's the thing about an eclipse. It's basically quite simple. The moon blocks the sunlight. Does it feel different based on where you watch? Or is it just an eclipse, no matter where you watch it?
Oh, no. It can be very different depending on where you are along the path, whether you're close to the center of the path or whether you're close to the edge. Now, when you go close to the center, then you get the maximum duration. But if you go out towards the edge, you get a lesser duration, but you also get other spectacular events. Just before it starts, you get a shimmering display around the edge of the sun called Bailey's Beads, and then a diamond ring when the last little point of the sun shines through a valley on the edge of the moon. You get those effects much more dramatically. For example, in 2013, I was in Gabon, which is on the west coast of Africa, and I was right on the edge of the eclipse path. And the sight was absolutely dramatic. Firstly, as the shadow was coming towards me, and I could see the edge of the shadow, but also as the eclipse went through, I could see the chromosphere, the crimson glow around the edge of the sun for the entire eclipse. It was absolutely dramatic. Okay. So, yes, it really makes a difference whether you're on the center line and get a longer duration or you go to the edge. You get less duration, but you get some more spectacular effects.
I'm just curious, in Gabon, how many eclipse tourist chasers were there with you?
Where I was, there was only one other group. I was out on the beach and I was just surrounded by locals. It's one of the features of an eclipse when you go to a place, you get to meet with the locals. And I spent some time in the local village there before the eclipse. I handed out eclipse glasses and a whole pile of them came out onto the beach and we shared the eclipse together. And they really add to the atmosphere. You know, they got so excited.
You've seen 15 eclipses from Svalbard, which is near the North Pole, to French Polynesia. What's been the most difficult eclipse to get to?
Well, the ones in the polar region, of course, are pretty difficult, and it's pretty cold when you get there. Also, got to see one in Antarctica. One of the things is that this can be expensive, so you've got to be very careful about costs. Going to Antarctica, for example, there was the opportunity to go on an icebreaker, which was way out of the ballpark as far as the cost that I could afford. But there was a flight out of Melbourne that went down to see the eclipse, and that was something different, seeing it from an aeroplane.
So what was that like? I mean, do you get to kind of spend more time in the path of totality if you're moving under the shadow?
Watching an eclipse from an aircraft has a unique advantage that the aircraft will usually travel along the eclipse path. It's actually traveling with the moon shadow, so you get an extended view of the eclipse. But the view itself was so spectacular because in the first instance, we're in the clear polar air, but also at 10,000 meters, you're looking through so much less atmosphere that looks so much clearer as well.
What keeps you coming back for more, Terry? You're on to eclipse number 16 next Monday.
Yeah, firstly, I suppose it's the pure spectacle of it. It's spine tingling. It's like nothing you've experienced before. But I like the photographic challenge. You only get one go at it. For the last 6 months, I've been really focusing on getting my photography program together. And a lot of it's pre-programmed. You can't afford to be fiddling with your camera during the eclipse. And the satisfaction, you know, if you nail those photographs, you know, you really, really enjoy it. But it's the travel too. You know, I like going to unusual places. So it's a real combination of all those things.
Terry Cuttle is an eclipse chaser from Australia who's heading to the U.S. to watch next Monday's eclipse. He's been speaking with us from Brisbane. Terry, thanks a lot. Good luck.
You too. Thanks, Marco.
You can see Terry Cuttle's photos of eclipses over the Great Wall of China and in his native Australia, all at PRI.org. It has been a very challenging few days for our country, and in times like these, it can help to check in with friends. So that's what we did today. I reached out to friend of the show, Wajahat Ali, to hear what he's thinking. He's a writer and attorney based in Washington. Wajahat, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's been an eventful week.
Yeah, and it's only Wednesday. Walk us through how you've been processing everything this week so far.
White supremacy is a hell of a drug, and it seems to make a segment of America lose their minds or perhaps reveal the worst angels of themselves. And one would wish that the president of the United States, the commander-in-chief, the elected official who is supposed to represent 350 million of his citizens, would be able to crush a meatball down the middle and say, I condemn white supremacy, an ideology of extremism that has caused terrorism, pain, and violence and betrays the values and principles of this country. But we have Donald Trump.
Why do you call white supremacy a drug?
Well, first of all, it's a Chappelle line, so I had to give a throwback to an old Chappelle sketch. But it lulls you in a strange way, doesn't it, right? It's the fuel, if you will, that has inspired so much of America, in the sense that the founding of this country is based upon an ideology of supremacy, that is white supremacy. It has fueled slavery. It has fueled segregation. It has fueled racism. It has fueled bigotry. And so it's this nice, comforting drug that gives a segment of America a bit of relief, a bit of catharsis, a bit of righteous anger, and a convenient boogeyman and enemy that they can always attack in order to make themselves feel great or safe or secure again.
I mean, I saw your tweet about having this uncomfortable conversation about white supremacy that America's avoided for nearly 300 years. And yet there's a sense that if it hadn't been for the live feed of the riot and the headline-grabbing death of Heather Heyer, maybe we wouldn't be talking about this right now, or at least the urgency wouldn't be there. Do you really think a meaningful national conversation, like not memes and opinions on social media, but a real sit-down to talk about white supremacy and slavery is coming soon?
No, but I remain hopeful. What will happen is that a lot of the people on the sidelines, Marco, a lot of my white moderate friends, some of my best friends are white moderate friends, didn't really take Islamophobia seriously or racism seriously. They thought, it's a thing of the past. It happens, you know, in the Deep South. There are small little, you know, examples of graffiti and vandalism. But with the election of Trump and the mainstreaming of modern hate and the fact that he's using the pulpit to essentially give defense and cover to part of his base, which are, let's be honest, white supremacists, the fact that it took him 2 days to condemn it. And then he did dog whistles on Twitter, and then he had this insane press conference yesterday, which was basically him. I don't know why anyone was shocked. I was not shocked at all. This has caused a lot of people to wake up and say, oh my God, maybe our friends who are people of color, minorities, Muslims, immigrants, Mexicans, people with ovaries, maybe they're onto something. Maybe there is a problem. And you know what? We let it go for far too long, but this is a country that belongs to the future of our children. And the lowest hanging fruit is have those honest, tough conversations where
so,
we applaud
so how do
when
we
Indiana
move
Jones
on?
Punched
how up. Do we move on from this point and have those conversations?
Well, first and foremost, I think is acknowledgement that this is a problem. Number two, condemn it loudly. Number three, actually listen. Listen to Americans. Listen to Black Lives Matters. Listen to undocumented immigrants. Listen to Muslims. Fourth, I would say engage in each other's space. What I mean by that is pop the bubble, get out of your isolated cocoon, take your head out of the sand, and maybe if you've never talked to a Muslim, go to a mosque. If you're a Muslim who's never talked to a Jew, go to a synagogue. Meet each other. Talk to each other. And then what I would say is have frank, blunt conversations. Don't try to hold the punches, but really say, listen, I don't know much, but I want to learn. I hope you don't mind. I might offend you with some ignorant questions, but I come from a place of sincerity.
How do you talk to people who don't see the world the same way as you do?
You know, look, I went to an all-boys Jesuit Catholic high school where I was the token Muslim. I'm used to dealing with people, engaging with people who have completely different political, cultural, religious opinions. But I say either there's values that unite us, and hopefully we can unite over this one simple idea that this country belongs to all of us, regardless of our race, ethnicity, or religion. When we were growing up, all of us always said, if it was World War II, we would do the right thing. Oh, if there's a crisis, we would be the hero. Oh, if anything went down, we would step up and be the protagonist of the narrative. This is that moment. This is that turning point. This is that crisis. This is where God or nature or destiny is staring you in the face and saying, stand up and throw down and be the hero.
So you're talking about this kind of maybe recent awareness or increased awareness of white privilege among whites. I kind of felt there was a cultural shift this week as well. Like Jimmy Fallon came out on Monday. Usually he's a late night punchline maven. He even kind of normalized Trump on his show last year. But Monday he was really taking on what happened in Charlottesville. He had this applause-free talk about the violence. And then last night featured Riz Ahmed, a British-Pakistani actor, performing a powerful slam poem about violence in the world, prejudice, and what he's feeling right now.
So listen. Terrorism isn't caused by religion or an old school vision of Islam. It's against the Quran, and it's a new innovation caused by mashup situations. That's what makes them turn to arms. The problem is modern, and it's all local factors. Dictatorships, injustices, and wars cause fatwas. So when these sour times, please allow me to vouch for mine. Bitter taste in my mouth, spit it out with a rhyme. Ayo, I'm losing my religion to tomorrow's headlines. But it's fine.
Do you think something changed this week culturally?
Dude, the guy who plays beer pong with celebrities was more presidential than the president. Let's just take a moment to absorb that. And my friend Riz, he's a great guy. I knew Riz before he was famous. I know Riz after he's famous. And what you saw on Jimmy Fallon with him reciting his powerful poem, Sour Times, is Riz throughout. And the fact that Jimmy gave Riz, a Muslim, a son of Pakistani immigrants, that type of platform to recite that poem that Riz wrote actually after 9/11 really speaks volumes. And I think Jimmy Fallon, the guy who jostled Trump's hair and had fun with the dude, he's the one who delivered a very sober, sincere condemnation of the violence, does give us some hope that even the jesters and the clowns and the people who were sitting on the sidelines realize that, wait a minute, I have a platform, I have an opportunity, it's my time to throw down and speak up. And that was very, very encouraging.
Wajahat Ali is a writer and attorney based in Washington, D.C. Waj, thanks very much for your time and your thoughts.
Thanks so much for always inviting me.
Yeah, when the late-night network comedians start getting serious and featuring slam poets who used to only be on HBO, you know something's going on. Anyway, we'll see where this takes us. But remember the various voices on the show today who said, despite Martin Luther King Jr.'s optimism, the arc of the moral universe doesn't bend toward justice all by itself. That's where we leave you today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.